Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
We're going to talk politics this morning. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington in this morning. Dr. Farnsworth, I say this every time, but we need to do this much more often than we do. Good morning. Good to have you getting up and coming in this morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And it's exam week. It's good to get to pull you away from exam week.
Well, you know, the blue books will be there when I finish, so
it
works out okay.
I haven't thought about or seen a blue book in years. That brings back memories.
Well, consider yourself lucky. You know, December is more pleasant for you than it is for 20-year-olds.
I guess so. I guess blue books. Boy, with technology and everything the way they are, there still are things in higher education that haven't changed.
Well, you could set up your final exam however you want, but with a blue book, I know it's not AI that's doing the work.
Yeah, that's right. Has AI, I just did, for the AI expert at UMW was just in a couple of weeks ago. We did a great show. Has that impacted what you do?
Well, I've been pretty deliberate about making sure that I'm grading the students' work. And so I use blue book exams. I have them talk in class, and I'm looking at the evaluations of stuff that is very clearly theirs. I'm not saying that students are figuring out a way to work through AI in a way that undermines them doing the learning, but we can see down the road that there will be some students who in some places will find it more useful to go to AI. So far, I think AI has proven to be kind of a disappointment for people who think that AI can replace people.
Yeah.
Let's hope that that there's still plenty of jobs and everything like that going forward, because AI is just this undiscovered country, I think, that when we think about how it's going to impact businesses or education or any one of a number of institutions, we're not sure what's going to happen next.
Yeah. To be discussed in future years for sure. But that's interesting that Blue Book would protect you, and you would know that someone has done the work.
Absolutely.
So we've got lots to talk about in the political world. I guess we'll start off and just talk about what happened a month or so ago in the November elections. Could it have gone any better in the statewide races or the Virginia House races for Democrats?
Well, I think it's important to remember, particularly in a state like Virginia, a purple state, the tide goes in and the tide goes out for a political party. And there was no doubt about it, this was a great year to be a Democrat in Virginia. The environment in Washington was very unfavorable for Republicans. President Trump, who of course lost Virginia three separate times, and not by close margins in any of those three elections, has never been that popular here. But then when you think about the government shutdown and you think about all those people who've lost their jobs or are at risk of losing their jobs, you think about all the anxiety. I mean, if you're in the business of selling gasoline or lunches to federal workers, you are also impacted by shutdowns and by force reductions. And so those kinds of things have this huge impact, not just in Northern Virginia, but Richmond, Hampton Roads, other places with significant federal employment.
Yeah.
And that just creates a lot of anxiety that is on top of the existing economic anxiety that people are now blaming Trump for. I mean, one of the bad parts of winning an election is then you're responsible for what happens and people are going to blame you. You may get too much credit in good times. You may get too much blame in bad times, but it's your name at the top of the ticket, and that's the reality. And so for the Republicans, it was a very difficult environment. And then Spanberger, of course, is an effective candidate. You talk about somebody who was very good at raising money, somebody who was very good at staying on message. You know, I think one of the key things that Spanberger demonstrated in this campaign is the value of being a disciplined candidate. During the debate, for example, Winsome Earle Sears tried over and over again to get her to get off message. Her message was, the economy stinks, Trump's to blame, and the Republicans in Virginia are not standing up to the president. So that message over and over again penetrates the voters' messages, the way they orient themselves to politics, and that's why she's governor-elect.
She was very disciplined. I can't remember. It's been a while since we've had a governor's race like that. It's just so lopsided. It never the polls never showed. Well, it was close.
Right. So you had the Trump effect, which I tend to think is a pretty big impact. Virginia is always going to be a state that is one of the first places to see buyer's remorse. You have a president election in 1 year. Virginia elects a governor the next year. The people most likely to turn out are the ones who are angry at what happened in Washington a year ago and what the new president is up to. And so that was great news for Youngkin 4 years ago, and it was great news for Spanberger this time. That is a key part of what motivates voters today, it seems. If you look at the polling, it's very much about anger. And so you're angry at who's ever in charge. And so be careful what you wish for, because once you win an election, people start blaming you for what's going on.
Well, and we've seen that in the Virginia General Assembly when Democrats won a few years ago, and that same kind of thing happened.
Right. And so now you have an environment where the gridlock, if you will, is probably more or less at an end. For the moment.
Right.
You know, when you had a Republican governor and a Democratic majority in the legislature, you had very little in the way of working together. One of the things that, you know, you and I have talked about a lot as we think about Virginia politics over the last 20 years is the extent to which it has become Washingtonized. That the trench warfare on Capitol Hill is now increasingly the trench warfare of politics in Virginia. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we had people like Senator Chichester, Senator Houck, you know, moderates of both parties figuring out where Virginia was going to go. And they told the extremists on both ends, this is where the votes are. This is the combination. And so we had kind of a moderate governing tradition back in those days where the environment, the Virginia way, I guess was the term we used to use, that's just not the case anymore.
It's gone.
There are no real rewards from the voters to being a moderate politician anymore. And so, needless to say, there aren't that many moderates who come up through the system. If there's going to be any tension in the legislature this year, it may very well be that the Democratic caucus wants to go much more in a liberal direction than the governor might want to go. So, you know, you're already seeing a little bit of disagreement on the question of right to work, for example. But there may be others, too. One of the things to appreciate, though, is that when the conversation occurs within a party, it's often easier to work out the differences. That's particularly true when there's a big majority.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that long ago when, you know, Speaker Bill Howell had two-thirds in the House who were Republicans. And he could basically say to the 10 most extreme Republicans, look, we're not going to go that far. Come up with something more moderate or you're on the outside. And, you know, he could make that choice. And the new speaker, you know, in the next session has basically the same opportunity. It's not quite as big a majority as what Bill Howell had back in the day, but it's still a majority that is a significant one where you can take those problematic members and basically tell them to play ball or they can stay outside. And those are going to create environments that are very, very effective towards working out an agreement with the governor's office, because some of the more far-left Democrats are going to end up being marginalized in the new General Assembly. That'd be my expectation with the speaker with that big a majority. When it's 51 or 52 seats, you got to keep everybody happy.
Yeah.
But when it's 64, you can tell a dozen to take a hike.
Well, the big news around here, and I think even statewide, the fact that Bobby Orach lost was a big surprise. He'd been there for over 30 years, and that seemed to be a district that he seat he could have as long as he wanted, and he lost.
Yeah, and you know that's the changing nature of this part of Virginia. If you think about how Virginia has changed over the last 20 years or 30 years, if we're thinking about Orach's seat, there has been a wave of suburbanization. Mm-hmm. Professor Hanna in the geography department and I have been writing about this a lot, but there's kind of a second wave of suburbanization that's going on in our area.
Right.
That's really kind of creating a very different demographic for the electorate. Even 20 years ago, I remember some elected officials telling me, it's like you're never an incumbent. There's so many new people moving into your district. You're always a challenger. Even when you've won an election and you've been on the ballot,
yeah.
A lot of people weren't on the weren't watching the ballot 4 years ago. They weren't in the district, and so the first wave of suburbanization, you know, people wanting more space, they wanted opportunity maybe to get out of the cities to have a more conservative traditional life. That was the first wave of suburbanization, say in the 70s and the 80s. The suburbanization wave now is almost entirely an affordability dynamic, where people are just looking for a place that they can buy and they can afford.
Yeah.
So they're not coming here for the conservative politics. They're coming here for convenience to the VRE, towards living somewhere near 95, but something that they could afford that they couldn't afford, say, in Prince William or Fairfax. And so those kinds of people are not going to be giving the Republicans the kind of tailwind that Republicans in this area had with the first wave of suburbanization. And so that dynamic creates a very, very different challenge, I think, for Republicans. Orrick was always an effective legislator. He was he had a record and a visibility that would have made him tough to be defeated. But the reality is that the district kind of moved in terms of these new residents, in terms of the new development, and that created a really difficult environment. To a lesser extent, we see the same thing with Mildy in Stafford.
Right.
This is another Republican-friendly district that has basically been changing because of new residents and creating an environment that is more unfavorable to particularly more conservative Republicans. I think that one of the challenges that Republicans are going to have to address going forward is how the party can be more appealing to some of these new voters. My guess is that the Republicans would be better off maybe focusing more on small government libertarian messaging. But that's not exactly the a narrative that works well with President Trump, who envisions that the federal government should be everywhere all the time, making even individual choices about individual tariffs with individual countries and individual products.
Quick break. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here from UMW. More on this and lots of other political talk this morning as we continue on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. You can access all episodes of Town Talk online at newstalk1230.net or on your favorite podcast streaming platform. Now, back to your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth in this morning as we talk politics this morning. As we talk about kind of the changing demographics, and I had forgotten that you and Professor Hannah had done that. And that's fascinating to look at those maps and everything. It is so interesting just on the local level to see what's happened to Stafford. The Stafford Board of Supervisors always, for you and I can remember just years and years when it was both Stafford and Spotsylvania, very, very Republican. Stafford now has changed. Spotsylvania's in the same way. And I'd get, just looking even at the Orrick race, you would think that Caroline probably that's gonna happen. And as you described it, people are moving down here because it's affordable.
Right. And what you see is that there's kind of an east-west divide with these counties. The closer you are to the VRE line, the closer you are to 95, the more Democratic those precincts are likely to be. And so that's where you're seeing the biggest changes. If you look at the acreage of Spotsylvania County or the or Stafford, you're going to see most of the acres in precincts are going to be Republican in their loyalties. But when you're looking at the population, you're really seeing that kind of blue sliver along 95. But, you know, this has been the dynamics where you look at Loudoun or Prince William before that. I mean, this is a challenge that Republicans have been facing in Virginia for a while. And one of the painful realities, I think, that the Republicans have now is that they're in the wilderness. You know, you don't have a single statewide elected official who's a Republican come January. You have basically a tiny minority in the House of Delegates. There's going to be a significant challenge, I think, for Republicans to basically compete in the messaging. Both of our senators, of course, in Virginia are Democrats. And then who knows how many House members will end up being Republicans, depending on the way that the lines are drawn. You know, you could be looking at a really, really parched environment for Republicans and statewide messaging. And that's something that's got to be pretty concerning to the Republican Party right now.
Yeah, you'd have to go back to the, you know, probably pre-George Allen days to see the Republican Party, you know, facing these kinds of questions in that little of people.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, the era of like Belials and Doug Wilder to think about like what was going on. But the challenge is pretty apparent. But it's also important to recognize that voters are consistently unhappy with whatever government does. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, Republicans will be back. But it creates a great opportunity for any ambitious Republican to try to elbow themselves to the front of the line, because there aren't that many people in front of you anymore.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. This is the chance now for someone to craft a message and to try to gain some traction for themselves and the party.
Yeah, I mean, that's not to say that some of the people who've run before won't run again. I could imagine Attorney General Meares as running another statewide election. I don't know that his defeat had all that much to do with him. I think it had to do with the fact that the Republicans were blown out at the top of the ticket. You know, I knew, some people working the Meares campaign, and, you know, their thought was that you could see Meares winning if the governor's race was relatively close. So if Winsome Earle-Sears lost by 7 points, 8 points, Meares might have been able to win. But when she loses by 15, you know, everybody's capsized.
Yeah. You and I talked before the election, and we had a fascinating discussion. The whole Jay Jones saga and what came out, some of the things that he had talked about before the election, and ended up it didn't hurt him, and that I think surprised a lot of people.
Well, you know, this was one of the areas where we really have seen a big change in politics. These kinds of comments 20 years ago would have been disqualifying.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine a candidate in the pre-Trump era having survived politically for the kinds of things that he said. But the reality is that people are now so partisan, so many people are, that they will forgive everything on their side and forgive nothing on the other side. And so, you know, I remember having this conversation with my students. I said, you know, think about parents listening to what he's talking about, the children in these texts. And, you know, how can you, you know, say this is somebody that I want to endorse? And, you know, a number of my students were saying, you know, the Republicans can cry me a river until they clean up the business with Trump. There's nothing.
I heard the same thing.
You know, I remember, you know, and this is one of the myths that people think, that professors are making students liberal. No, the students are way more liberal than we are as a group. It's astonishing sometimes how many people get that idea about higher education wrong. We don't manipulate students. Yeah. We can't even get them to do the reading sometimes. And so it's important to recognize just how limited our impact is. But it is a target that is very, very clear. And so if you are looking at politics today, people will look at that D or R after your name. They look to see which team you're on. They know which team they're on, and that's pretty much the end of it. It's astonishing how little the conversation is about elections relating to policy matters. You know, we have a governor's election, and almost nothing was said about what's going to be the future of Virginia. Almost everything was focused on Trump or focused on Jay Jones' text. And so nothing really about, like, how we're going to deal with development. I mean, particularly if you're thinking about, like, these data centers and you know, the economic impact, particularly in our region, this is an immense challenge. There is a lot of money involved. There is a lot of economic impact, positive and negative, that people are going to be fighting over. But we don't have a statewide plan, and that's a mistake. If you're giving each county, the government, the choice to figure out how to change the statewide electoral grid, you're creating a disaster.
Yeah.
We didn't have a conversation about that. And so now, you know, everybody's calling audibles in the individual cities and counties around Virginia, trying to figure out, can they get some piece of this pie? And you know who's going to be paying the bill? Ratepayers. Because the electricity capacity of Virginia is nowhere near what's going to be required if even only a fraction of these things go online.
Or the water that's going to be required.
There's water too.
And you look at the Rappahannock River and you see that the Caroline just got a permit to... to withdraw what 9 million gallons a day, and if that continues with what's going to happen there?
Well,
so you're right, and that never came up. That you never saw candidates talking about that.
Yeah, and we're looking at an environment that is really, really constrained. I mean, the good news for Virginia is always that people want to live here, that people look to Virginia and say, this is a place where I can live, I can find a job, I can raise a family, I can do what I want to do. Virginia always has that advantage. But on the other side, the flip side of that is there's a constant pressure for development, constant pressure for changing things in ways that are not always considered in the long term. You know, when you decide to build these big developments, you know, what about the electricity going into the data centers? When you decide to build big residential developments, what about the water? What about the sewer? What about the electric capacity? What about the schools? You know, there are all kinds of things that come downstream. The developers, you know, build the houses, and then, you know, local governments often have to deal with the challenges that come through the good news, if you will. I mean, you know, no one says, oh, you know, let's trade our economy for that of our neighboring West Virginia. But the reality is that we have a lot of challenges, and those challenges don't get discussed in these partisan times. In particular, I did kind of a deep dive into healthcare, you know, the one big beautiful bill and the impacts of healthcare as it relates to Virginia. And one of the big challenges for the legislature in January is going to be how to deal with all the additional costs that Virginia is going to face, or the reduced healthcare that comes from the choices that were made in that one big beautiful bill at the federal level, because Virginia has to cover millions of dollars in all kinds of different ways for the healthcare challenges that are now going to be dumped on states because the federal government, through that one big beautiful bill, pushed them to the state level.
Mm. And again, that has not been talked about. And when those kinds of things come up, and a lot of times when either you're paying more, all of a sudden you're throwing your hand, you know, the electric. What happened? I didn't hear anything about this.
Well, you know, people want, you know, what they get right now. They want $1.25 in government services for $1 in taxes. But that's not a sustainable environment. You know, we can't go to the grocery store and get $1.25 in groceries for $1 in payment. But we can do that with taxes because the federal government can deficit spend. And so I think that one of the big, big challenges that politicians are always going to face is that people have gotten used to a system that's unsustainable. And when you try to pull them away from that, that's not going to be appealing.
Yeah.
And so, I was thinking about this the other day. You know, if we think about the crises of, say, in the immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor, you know, people were like saving fat on the stove and things like that. There was a draft. The people were rationing food and clothing. You couldn't buy an appliance during World War II. You know, people were really willing to sacrifice for the greater good of winning the war and getting those troops back home sooner rather than later. Now people aren't willing to do this least little thing. Yeah. After 9/11, when Bush said it was like Pearl Harbor, he didn't say, okay, and so this is what we're going to do. We're going to have conscription. We're going to have rationing. We're going to have tax increase. No, we got a tax cut, and we were told to go shopping. You know, talk about a sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know? But I think Bush had it right. I don't think that the American public was willing to pay for the kinds of prices that would be involved in the kind of challenges that that Bush engaged in. I mean, we fought the war in Iraq and Afghanistan on a credit card, basically, and we still haven't paid the bill.
Right.
And each year, we're building up a greater and greater debt for the next generation. It is a constant problem. But anybody who tries to offer up a message that you have to figure out a way to live within your means, well, they're not going to be elected to anything.
No, absolutely not. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here, professor of political science and international affairs at UMW and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies. More coming up. We'll talk about the governor. We'll talk about redistricting and bunch of other things this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:31.
From the Fredericksburg FreePress.com studios, this is News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA, sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. You can weigh in about today's topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230 and by text at 540-371-5756. Here's your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth in this morning. Good stuff as we talk about kind of things that we're all dealing with and talking about and thinking about. The just a few weeks left of the Youngkin administration. As someone who's a political analyst, how do you look at the last 4 years with Governor Youngkin?
Well, I think Youngkin was very good at running for governor.
Yeah.
I think that his real skill and the skill of his campaign team was figuring out the opportunity that was presented in 2021, and that, you know, put him in the governor's office. The challenge, though, that he faces, and this is often a challenge for newbie governors who haven't served in the legislature, is dealing with the legislature. I think that the governors that are more successful are the ones who have come through the legislature and know how the legislature works. Not only do they know the players, but they know the process. And I think Youngkin imagined that the legislature worked for him in some fashion. Mm-hmm. That these are not co-equal branch of government. You know, that I think that this is a problem. If you come from business and you think like a CEO, you're going to run into a significant problem. If you think, for example, just to pick one issue, the sports arena idea near National Airport.
Yep.
You know, this could have been something that could have been kind of a signature Youngkin accomplishment. It would have been a huge thing for Virginia to have gotten professional sports moving from D.C. into Northern Virginia. But the price of getting it was high, and he wasn't willing to pay it. You could have found a way, I imagine, if you'd been willing to make more compromises. The legislature has to be on board, and that means you have to pay the price. And there was never, I would say, a serious conversation about paying the price. Here's an idea. I want you to accept it.
Right.
Was the sort of Youngkin approach. And I think that that's a significant challenge for people who haven't served in the legislature. They don't get that you have to go hat in hand and you have to be much more cooperative. Now, there's no doubt that the price for getting the approval of the Democratic majority Senate would have been high. Remember, there's a lot of resentment over the way that the Senate has been given the back of the hand by the governor on questions of education and schools and parental rights and those kinds of issues. There's a lot of executive orders and things like that that the governor did that made the legislature angry. But there could have been a deal. And there wasn't a deal. And so what you have, and this gets back to the idea that Washington is just a big Richmond now, or Richmond is a small Washington, that you just basically have this partisan division where there's no real compromise. And so you walk away after 4 years as governor without all that much in the way of significant legislative accomplishments.
I can't think of many.
The governor has been successful, as governors usually are, at economic development. I mean, that's somewhere, the one place where we could still kind of imagine a bipartisan vision in Virginia is that issue of economic development. He's brought a lot of jobs to Virginia, as his predecessors have too. And that's been successful. But that's not something that requires the legislature to have a significant buy-in either. There's money for economic development. Both parties approve it. Both parties engage in it. And it works. But if you're thinking about, like, what comes next for Youngkin politically, Karl Rove doesn't think there's much of an electoral future for the guy. He thought that the really powerful anti-Republican message coming out of Virginia demonstrates that Youngkin's message isn't resonating.
Yeah.
But you could certainly imagine Youngkin getting a job in the Trump administration.
That's what I wonder.
You know, right now it looks like Homeland Security may have a vacancy soon, but we'll see. Youngkin's forte, I think, as a cabinet member, would be in this area of economics, of business development, and things like that. And so, depending on what happens with respect to any kind of cabinet reshuffle, there may be opportunities for Youngkin in Washington. I don't know that his brand as a candidate for office right now is a particularly strong one. But he was always an effective voice for Republicans on Fox News and other places where he would get seen by Republicans. And if you're thinking about successful Republican governors, Youngkin won and did well in Virginia. His victory in 2001 seems particularly noteworthy when one considers Republican successes or failures in the years since then. When we're looking at the elections of 2025 and the special elections and the Virginia elections, you see that Trump has really hurt the Republican brand with swing voters in all kinds of places, including county races in Pennsylvania. And so those kinds of things may make Youngkin an appealing choice for a cabinet secretary or something like that. The choice, though, of an elected office, it seems like that may not be in the cards for the immediate future for him.
We talk about his lack of working with the legislature. I would think that Governor-elect Spanberger, her time in Congress will. She's dealing with House and Senate majorities. Will be a little bit. The transition will be a little bit easier for her.
Yeah, I think that Spanberger's time in Congress will give her an advantage because she understands that the legislature needs to be a key part of governing for this process to work out. And of course, you have to remember that Democrats are going to agree on 2/3 or more of policies to mm-hmm. start with. If you're thinking about the issues on the on economic development, if you're thinking about the issues on the environment, if you're thinking about issues on budget, there's going to be a lot of agreement on a lot of those kinds of concerns. Spanberger, I think, is and this is an important thing in politics that's not always present. She's a listener, and I think that's a key thing that gets you towards more success in politics. When she was in Congress representing the Fredericksburg area,
I would say she came here a lot. She was just what she said.
She was a listener. She mm-hmm. She went to communities in the district that weren't all that Democratic in their loyalties, but she would go and she would hear what was going on. Mm-hmm. And she figured out ways that the Democrats could connect with, say, more rural voters, for example. And that is a key thing to have in politics. I think too many politicians these days talk and not listen. And I think that is a skill that will serve her well in terms of dealing with the legislature. You have to recognize that in these combative times, and limited resources and great challenges, these things are not easy to manage. The challenges, the policy challenges that Virginia faces may be more manageable than some states, but there's still significant challenges. And a willingness to reach out and connect and listen to lawmakers is going to be a key metric for how well or how poorly our next governor does, just like it was a key metric for how well or how poorly our current governor does.
Yeah. Doing. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here from UMW. This is a topic. This next topic we'll talk about. We'll touch on it today, and I have a feeling that as it continues to develop, we'll do more shows on this. This whole redistricting idea is fascinating, and if everything comes through the way, if the General Assembly approves it and voters approve it, we could have a much different, as far as a map goes, for congressional candidates in Virginia soon.
Yeah, it's like a variation of that old joke about the weather. If you don't like the congressional district you're in, just wait 5 minutes.
Right.
You could very well find yourself in a new congressional district 6 months from now. My guess is that given the size of the Democratic victories and the majorities in the House of Delegates and the continuing majority in the Senate, the voters are quite likely to approve the plan that would give the constitutional amendment approval, would give the authority for the legislature to redraw the congressional districts. It's important to note that what's being talked about now would not change the House of Delegates or the Senate districts in Virginia, but it would change the congressional districts. And Democrats have plans at the extreme to create a vision for Virginia that they think would be 12-1 or 10-1 rather for the congressional district. Right now, it's 6 Democrats, 5 Republicans. That seems like a pretty significant stretch. I think one of the things that people are going to find out with this redistricting is that it's going to have a significant backlash. I think people are going to be really mad about it. And I also think that if you take, like they did in Texas, and create an environment where there are, you know, spreading those Republican voters over a larger number of districts, you may end up not getting those 5 districts as a net plus that you think you're going to get. Remember, in a midterm election, the president's party loses on average 18, 20 seats. And so you may be basically serving up on a platter new winnable seats for Democrats by lowering the Republican majorities in some of these places. This is a really, really risky strategy for Republicans to engage in right now, given the natural disinclination of midterm electorates to support the president's party. This is a bigger problem for Republicans than for Democrats when they're trying to redistrict, because buyer's remorse of a midterm election is going to hurt the president's party. But the challenge, I think, is become apparent when you think about Indiana. You know, Indiana has been the sort of ground zero for presidential pressure on redistricting over the last several weeks. And the legislature just this week said no. They're not going to draw the lines again. They're not going to try to find another congressional district or two for the Republicans in Indiana. And this is a Republican majority, a huge supermajority in the Republicans in the legislature in Indiana. But they looked at the configuration of their state, and they thought this might not be so good for Republicans to do this. But they also had this idea, and this is an old Republican idea, that there's federalism here. This is a state business, and we don't need people in Washington telling us how to run things in our state. And so, for a bunch of reasons, I think the Republicans are at risk of overplaying their hand in these congressional redistricting efforts. And the Republicans in Indiana have come to the same conclusion, that it's not worth it to put more potential Republican seats on the table and run the risk of losing even more seats in an unfavorable midterm environment.
Do Virginia Democrats take that approach, or what do you think?
Well, I think Virginia Democrats have the advantage that Republicans are going to be the party facing the problem in the midterm election, because there's a Republican president. If Harris were president, the Republicans would be in the driver's seat and would be in a great position to pick up seats in the midterm election. But Trump is president, and that's an issue. I think that 10 would be a stretch. I could see. As I look at the map of Virginia, I could see a seat pickup, 2 seat pickup, that kind of, a more modest thing. You could, you know, for example, Congressman Whitman, who used to represent this area, he represents now, further down the Northern Neck, and then the areas south of Fredericksburg around Richmond, including some Chesterfield and Henrico voters. You put a little bit of the city of Richmond in there. You give him a few more blue precincts in Henrico. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are in a position maybe that they win the first district. Remember, Spanberger won that district in terms of her gubernatorial election. So, you know, you could see, for example, that seat becoming a seat that Democrats could pick up. The other seat that strikes me as particularly vulnerable is Kiggins' seat, the second district in Hampton Roads.
Yeah.
This was a district that Democrats had previously been represented by Congresswoman Loria. That's a district that could be, again, tinkered with, creating an environment that that creates a more favorable situation for Democrats. I mean, in many ways, you know, it's the old saying that an eye for an eye makes everybody blind. Whenever we talk about redistricting, I think it's important to note that you're depriving voters of choices when you deliberately design systems that are not specifically designed to help one party over the other. Voters don't have as many real choices. We don't have necessarily a good environment at the bottom of the process. But Democrats have come to the conclusion that when Republicans started it, they intend to finish it. And so, you know, you can understand why the Democrats don't want to engage in unilateral disarmament. You know, Virginia, California, and a number of states have tried to put forward good government movement initiatives to try to match up district lines with existing lines for cities and counties, things like that. But the reality is when there's a redistricting in Texas, the only way to level the playing field is a redistricting in California.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the voters in California perfectly willing to do.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here. We're going to wrap it up and talk about your latest book. We'll talk a little bit of political humor to wrap this up this morning. Good stuff with Dr. Farnsworth. We'll be back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Sponsored by Green Line Service Corp. Miss a part of the show? No problem. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And now, back to your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth in this morning. Great stuff from the University of Mary Washington as we talk politics. So you've got a book out, Late Night in Washington. It is political humor. And we could talk politics we could talk politics for a couple of hours on this show, but this is a good way to wrap it up. Talk about the book, where people can get it, and we've talked about it before. It's a great book that looks at, because political humor and late night political humor has become a thing.
Well, absolutely. I think, as you know, we've discovered across the hour, there's a lot of bleakness in politics today.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that's really interesting to look at as a scholar, as well as a political junkie, is the orientation of political humor and the importance that it increasingly plays in people and their orientations towards politics. Political humor, in some ways, you can think of it kind of like a gateway drug to politics.
Mm-hmm.
That for people who are really not political junkies, political humor is a way to sort of learn a little bit more about politics and connect a little bit more about politics. A joke about Mitch McConnell isn't funny if you don't know who Mitch McConnell is. You know, a joke about some policy development isn't funny unless you know a little bit about what's going on. You need to have this kind of backstory for the political humor to get to make sense, for the joke to land well. And so we see through various political public opinion polls and things like that, that increasingly people are looking at political humor as a significant part of their learning about politics. It's not obviously as big as social media. It's not as big as network news, but it's comparable to newspapers and radio in terms of where people are getting information about mm-hmm. politics. And it's an audience that is particularly not inclined to get information about politics elsewhere. Now, you could say it would be better if they were reading the newspaper than hearing the late night monologues to learn about healthcare policy. Sure, absolutely. But if they're not going to learn about it anyway, mm-hmm. Then the political humor is the way in which you might get people connected. And what we see is actually that people who do start consuming political news, they have higher levels of political knowledge, and they're more likely to vote, and so they become more engaged. And so this may be a way, particularly when you're thinking about disaffected younger folks, to get people more connected to politics.
Interesting. And it certainly has changed over the years. You look at political humor in the days of Johnny Carson, and you look at the political humor in the days of Jimmy Fallon, and of how things have changed.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's potentially a challenging environment for political humor in terms of business is the extent to which that the coverage of political conversation in these political humor shows is incredibly anti-Republican right now. The jokes, for example, in the presidential campaign, you know, the Democratic candidate versus a Republican mm-hmm. candidate. Republican candidates are always going to be mocked more on these shows. My co-author Bob Lichter and I and Farah Lateef, my co-authors, we have worked on coding these jokes across campaign elections going back into the 80s. And every single election cycle, the coverage is more critical of Republicans. The jokes are more directed at Republicans than Democrats. And that gap has widened over time. And now it's more than 9-1 if you think about Harris versus Trump or
yeah.
Biden versus Trump and Clinton versus Trump as well. So this kind of gap is a potential problem. Of course, conservative humor is now a thing too. There's a show called Gutfeld on Fox News that is offering up a conservative take on political humor.
Okay.
So there is a via, and that has solid ratings. It's a profitable venue for political humor now. So there is a wider range of political humor out there that is commercially successful, and some of it, of course, more Democratic oriented, some of it more Republican oriented. But either way, the result is the same. We're seeing people get more interested in politics, learning more about politics, participating, more likely to participate because of the start that they've gotten in politics through political humor. It's really, really an interesting dynamic, and it's been something that over the last few years I found a very interesting thing to study.
And social media then is the other component to all of this.
Right. I mean, you've got to remember, most people these days are not staying up till 11:30 to watch these shows.
Absolutely.
What they do is they get the peer-to-peer communication the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Even the New York Times runs a daily column about the best stuff on the political late night shows and that comes out overnight. And so you can and so even the New York Times has decided this is worth a daily report of what's going on. So it's a great place for people to get their information because they can get it with social media, get it whenever. You can watch these shows. They are some of the more prominent things that are out there on in social media. Those kinds of opportunities, you know, create a potential financial challenge, right? I mean, one of the reasons why we're thinking about shrinking political humor is because of the challenges financially. You know, the end of the Colbert Show, the threat to Jimmy Kimmel and
Thanks
others.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk.
Late Night in Washington, political humor in the American
WFVA,
presidency.
Dr.
Farnsworth, thank you.
We'll
talk soon.
Thank you.
The host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. Hear the show anytime by subscribing to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite streaming platform. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.